Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer with you on WNYC. And now President Obama's former press secretary, Robert Gibbs. He's doing a 92nd Street Y event tonight at 8 with Ari Fleischer, the former George W. Bush secretary, press secretary. Robert, thanks so much for giving us some time today. Welcome to WNYC.
Thanks for having me.
And listeners, you know what I'm going to invite you to do now, right? Ask the press secretary. If you have ever fantasized about being a member of the White House press corps, now's your chance to live it out for a minute or so on the air. I only challenge you to ask a good question. If you're going to get called on by White House press secretaries, they better think you're going to ask a good question. So come up with one and call it in at 212-433-WNYC, not our pledge line. We'll never ask you for money on the air. 212-433-9692, and we'll put you on with Robert Gibbs. So, Robert, as a press secretary, how much is it your job to fight public ignorance? Like, we saw the recent stats on how people oppose Obamacare, but they support the Affordable Care Act. Hello?
Right.
So is fighting that ignorance in your job description?
To some degree, absolutely. I mean, particularly around, let's take sign up for health care. We still have a tremendous number of people that don't either know what's being offered through the Affordable Care Act or what will be legally required of them by the end of this year. So certainly public education and public information are a very big part of what you have to do, particularly when you're implementing something as big and as complex. And quite frankly, something like the Affordable Care Act that has gone through not just so many iterations, but has been, you know, subject to literally hundreds of millions of dollars in negative advertising, even before this has kicked off. So public education and public information, I think, have to be a big part of the role as the White House spokesperson.
How much time did you spend with the president per day, or however you want to express it, and how specific did you get about what words to use in your messaging?
You know, I think, you know, to be successful at the job of press secretary, you have to have as much access as is required for you to do that job. And I felt I had that access, and I was able to go into so many different meetings. I spent a lot of time each day in the same meetings that he was in, listening to the questions that he was asking, listening to the answers that the policy teams had, because I felt that information was really important when I briefed the press. And so you end up spending, you know, several hours each day in there with him. And you know, I was fortunate. I'd known him for a pretty long time. I'd worked with him. I'd spent a ton of time with him, traveling literally next to him on an airplane for months and months and months in the presidential race. I had a good idea of how he thought about things and how he would phrase things. So we only occasionally would get into sort of particular wordings of answers, largely because I felt like I had a pretty good sense of how he thought about different answers.
And so particular words, like there was that moment where the president decided that he was going to start calling it Obamacare himself. Were you in on that?
No, I had been gone at that point. And look, I think that's an interesting – in some ways a very interesting decision because, you know, I saw some poll that was done, I think, by CNBC, which basically said calling it Obamacare actually makes those that support the law more excited about it, but also those that oppose the law more in opposition to it. So it's a little bit of a conundrum, I guess, in that sense.
All right, folks, ask the press secretary, 212-433-WNYC. Adam in Brooklyn, you're on the air. Hi, Adam.
Good. Thanks for taking my call, Brian. I'm a devoted listener and also a standing member. You'd be happy to hear.
Thanks so much.
So, Mr. Gibbs, I donated to Obama's campaigns, and I voted for him, hoping that he would be a transformational figure. 5 years in, I worry that my optimism was naive. Do you think that President Obama personally and constitutionally is unsuited to be effective in Washington? Should I have supported a brawler and a schmoozer like a Bill Clinton? type figure?
Well, look, I will tell you this. I think having worked in Washington for a fairly long time, I will tell you one of the biggest things in dealing with Washington right now is Washington has changed. The nature of Congress and the makeup of Congress, for instance, when Bill Clinton was, as you said, a schmoozer and was dealing with a lot of the same maybe budget fights that the president is dealing with, four times the number of congressional districts in this country were occupied by Republicans in Congress but had been won by him in a presidential race. Almost 80 of those congressional districts existed. Now less than 20 of those congressional districts exist. And quite frankly, it is very difficult. It's very difficult to get somebody to do, you know, something in a congressional district where they got 70% of the vote and the president got 30% of the vote. I think the president was and still is the right person for that job. It is very, very hard right now to break this fever in Washington. And because right now, compromise is a bad word. Being able to sit down with people and giving them a little bit so that you each get a little bit is looked on as personal weakness. That's not just me saying that. That's what each of our bases in each political party think. That's in some ways how the media covers this. If you had to give this up, you were weak, and therefore. So, look, I think, you know, the president in some ways is a victim of the time and the circumstance of how Washington is operating right now.
Adam, thank you for your call. David in Manhattan, ask the press secretary. You're on WNYC with Robert Gibbs. Hi.
Hi, Mr. Gibbs.
Good morning.
Hello. I campaigned very hard for President Obama the first time, mm-hmm. and during his first term, he was doing a lot of things to disappoint me, and I was wondering, should I campaign for him again? And then you made that very disparaging remark about Upper West Side liberals, a population with which I identify, if not Upper West Side socialists. And I was wondering what in the world was in your mind. And I must also tell you that if you hadn't resigned, I would not have campaigned for him. But I did the second time.
So no fan of you. Now, you said something about, was it professional liberals?
For everybody on the Upper West Side or Upper East Side, I never said that. I'm a progressive myself. What I was venting at, and I hope the caller is still listening, what I was venting at are people that don't have a strong set of beliefs, but because they own a website or they make money off of a website, they've decided to take up a political argument that they don't understand because it drives traffic to them, because they've taken a position on that's different than the president's. That's what I've termed the professional left, somebody who it's not liberals that elected the president. For goodness sakes, I'm one of those, and I've got plenty of scars to prove it. So my remark was not to disparage people of a certain political thought. Mine was to disparage people that have a motive simply to get noticed in our society by trying to take on the president for not being liberal enough. It wasn't, again, it's not activists that I was venting at. It was those who are, as I said, the professional left.
But you turned off people like that caller who presumably don't have a professional interest in disparaging the president, but identify with the message of those who do, that the president wasn't being progressive enough for him. Do you regret your remark?
No, I don't. I regret that in some ways it appears to have been misunderstood. I think I'd made the remark not long after, you know, watching, quite frankly, we had a debate for more than a year about our healthcare system. And at the very end, I watched people that I thought made up the professional left railing against the healthcare mandate because they said, well, this healthcare mandate, all this mandate is a big boon to insurance companies. And if you'll recall, during the presidential race, we didn't have a mandate in our healthcare plan. And I actually, in a meeting, argued why we didn't have a mandate in the plan. I thought it made sense to have a mandate in the plan. Mm-hmm. I also understood the politics of it. I lost that argument. The president switched his position and had a mandate because, quite frankly, It is hard to get insurance companies. It's impossible to get them to cover things like pre-existing conditions if all you have in the insurance pool are sick people.
Right.
You have to get healthy people over there.
The notion
that we stood on the precipice of getting health care reform after 70 years of trying, and you had people complaining that, oh, well, all this really is just one big boon to the insurance companies. Was I upset? Absolutely. Huh. I'm still upset about those remarks.
So let me play you a critic of the individual mandate from the other side. It's Senator Marco Rubio on CBS this morning. Mm-hmm. Calling for a delay of the individual mandate because with the problems with the website rollout, you shouldn't be penalized for not having something that's this hard to buy. Listen.
Right. All I'm calling for is a delay on that requirement until the General Accounting Office of the United States certifies that the website is up and working and functioning and has been functioning for 6 consecutive months. I think that's a prudent approach.
Does Marco Rubio have a point?
Well, I think what's important is we have to make the website work. I think here's what I think is a bit cynical about what Senator Rubio is talking about. Senator Rubio knows that if you don't have, as I just discussed, if we don't have a mandate, then you can't have health care reform, right? Because all you would do is get the very sickest and those that had never been able to get insurance before able to get into a system for the first time in their lives. But if we didn't compel everyone to be in that system, the free rider problem of paying out benefits for those that weren't paying for insurance would or could collapse any healthcare system. So the first thing we've got to do is get the website right. And I do not think that people will be penalized for something they can't buy because I think they will fix the website. Mm-hmm. And if need be, we can delay the point in which the penalties come into play, or you can expand the open enrollment period to allow more people to go on and be able to access the website or the call centers or any other different way to sign up for health care.
You made news last week saying people should be fired over the Obamacare website rollout. Did you have anyone in mind?
Well, look, I made a pointed reference to making sure that we fix it first, because I think here's the problem. The people that are working on the website, if we fired all of them, we would be in even worse straits because they're the ones that know what's working and what isn't right now. I think there will be time afterwards to figure out who from the contractor section and who at the Department of Health and Human Services, quite frankly, just wasn't doing their job. Hmm. And it's, you know, look, it's nothing personal. It's just, you know, I think this is something that has to get done and has to get done right.
Ask the press secretary, Ann. In Nassau County, you're on WNYC with former Obama Press Secretary Robert Gibbs. Hi, Ann.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Good, thank you. I was just wondering, do you think that racism has played any part in the derisiveness against President Obama from the very beginning, from the get-go?
Yeah. You know, it's a good question, and you know, it's one I've thought some degree about. Do I still think there are certainly pockets in the country that are not used to the fact that there's an African American as a president? I definitely do. I don't think the opposition to him from members of Congress is because of his race. I think it's, you know, they have a very different set of political beliefs, and quite frankly, what we've seen really since, in all seriousness, since the probably last 6 months of Bush's term, has been a very big reaction to government, whether it was the bailouts for banks or for the auto companies that were started under President Bush, to the Recovery Act, has, I think, in many ways really driven the Republican Party much, much farther to the right than it had been in the George W. Bush administration. So I think most of that opposition, if not all of it, is political beliefs.
I'll be curious to hear Ari Fleisch's response to that in the 92nd Street Y event tonight. I want to play a clip of one of the more contentious moments of you in action as White House Press Secretary.
Mm-hmm.
The late Dean of White House Reporters, Helen Thomas, is grilling you in this clip about how controlled public information is getting.
Which question did you object to at the town hall meeting, Helen?
It isn't.
What's a pattern?
It's a pattern of controlling the press.
How so? Is there any evidence currently going on that I'm controlling the press? Poorly, I might add.
Your formal engagements are prepackaged.
How so?
Well, and controlling the public.
How so? By calling reporters the night before to tell them they're going to be called off? That is shocking.
We've had this discussion ad nauseum.
Of course you would, because you don't have any answers.
Helen Thomas and Robert Gibbs, when he was the Obama press secretary, he is with us. Sure. And we're going to run out of time soon. But what was the conversation you had ad nauseum with Helen Thomas?
Well, I'm trying to think back exactly. I mean, Helen is an institution. And I wrote a piece for Time magazine when she passed away. I remember watching Helen Thomas on TV grill presidents. So I knew I had finally made it to the White House when she was grilling me. She was a genuine trailblazer in the White House press corps. Helen was probably upset at either some manner of, just the fact that in many ways what she found events and news to be very prepackaged. I think she was actually also arguing the notion of, I used to give, and I think that they still do this, I would give the president a list of people to call on for a press conference. And in the first press conference we did at the White House, Helen Thomas was on that list. And on occasion, I would tell people before the press conference, hey, just so you know, be ready, the president's likely to call on you. And I didn't think there was anything untoward or unethical. I just thought, quite frankly, it looked more
organized.
It looked a little bit more organized when the president would look down and say, Helen Thomas.
But is it and this will be my last question because we'll be out of time, but does it play into a pattern that I guess Helen was referring to there in the longer version of her question, that if you look at the arc of change of how information is doled out over the course of presidential administrations over her long career, it seems to me that each president has fewer and fewer actual news conferences. I don't know the actual number, but that and other things. Is public information being controlled more and more and more by the White House over time?
Well, I think there will, as long as there is a White House and as long as there's a press corps, there will be a tension about that exact question. This president probably by number has done fewer press conferences than some of his predecessors, but I know has done far more individual interviews, either with news organizations, newspapers, blogs, all that sort of stuff, than other presidents have done. So I think each president, based on, who they're trying to reach and how they're trying to reach them, picks different avenues. And I'll give you one example. I mean, I remember in the very beginning of the administration, I advocated the president go on Jay Leno, and people told me I was crazy. But I said, it's access to people that don't normally watch news. And if you go back and look at the first 4 years of this administration, the president first talks about drone strikes on Jon Stewart's show because he asked him a good question about it. So I think you can't limit the sources of where you get those news for being good news, because somebody like Jon Stewart, who is really, really smart, can ask a really good question and get news from the president.
Former White House Press Secretary Robert Gibbs, he will be in conversation at the 92nd Street Y tonight at 8 o'clock with former Bush Press Secretary Ari Fleischer. I really appreciate you coming on with us. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, sir.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Our next guest, the legendary Circuit Court of Appeals judge Richard Posner, in a new book. It's kind of Posner versus Scalia. And we will hear Richard Posner, our next guest. Stay with us.